session of March 23rd, 1977. Before beginning, I'll give the exact schedule of the last meetings of this year. Before the Easter vacation, there'll be another class, the last one that's trimester. Yes, you're right. Today is the 23rd. The last class will be the 30th, then vacation. And then three sessions, April 20th, April 27th, May 4th. And that will be all. Today I will deal with three figures. This is how the alphabet decided. The first one, entitled Marginalities. In the Occident, especially after the 10th century, there was an inclination toward idiorhythmy. The inclinations with idiorhythmy took an exemplary form in Mount Athos in the 10th century. A few years ago, they celebrated a millenary anniversary of Mount Athos. One recognizes the right for certain individuals or individuals in very small groups to live apart from the community, at a distance from the community centers. This is the Scites on Mount Athos, very small groups of monks living in idiorhythmy, not far from the main monastery. You see this later with the Carthusian. In literature, at the beginning of Brothers Karamazov, the Tsarets Zosima. He's in a monastery but lives apart. In consequence, idiorhythmy is always an experience of marginality. But in the Occident, at least, that marginality is itself secondary, isolated, with regard to a first marginality, that of cenobitism itself, which is a first marginality. First marginality, second marginality of idiorhythmic communities. A few words about that first margin, cenobitism. What were they doing in those convents? Let's go back to simple things. For three or four centuries, Christianity was persecuted. At that time, Christians were excluded from power. It was a painful marginality at that time. Embodied itself in the historical figure of the martyr. Then, after Constantine's conversion, there was a reversal. From year 313 AD, the Christians came into power, the Edict of Milan, it recognized the Christians, gave them responsibilities and material advantages. There was immediately a reconstitution within Christian power itself of marginal zones. They were the monasteries. The monk is the successor, as it were, the hypostasis of the martyr. Monks took the place of martyrs. The monk is indeed literally an exceptional individual, even when he lives in a community. In the spiritual sense, there is a dense concentration of the sacred among monks. In the worldly sense, the monk is also exceptional. In the 4th century, the monastic condition is associated with an aristocratic conception. It's what is called in Latin otium, the leisure, a way of life that is not productive in economic terms. He is not supposed to work, but this is compensated by an overproduction in spiritual or intellectual matters. There is, among Benedictines, a production of erudition and copying before printing. It shows that the symbolic is a luxury. Society needs symbolic systems, but they are a certain luxury. At the same time, no society can do without the symbolic. Without the symbolic, mankind dies. Since one created the category of somatic illness or psychosomatic categories, we know that one of the theories is that a somatic illness comes to the body because of an absence of symbolization. It's when a given subject cannot symbolize that he or she becomes sick. At the origin of many psychosomatic diseases, we see a defect of symbolization. This defect of symbolic power that can lead to death. If man cannot symbolize, he or she dies. And in a therapeutic manner, in order to cure a disease, one can give back to the subject a possibility of symbolizing. In other words, one of the therapeutic ways is to be able to neuroticize the subject. Neurosis acknowledges the symbolic.
Permettre à l'homme au sujet de ne plus être malade, psychosomatiquement, il faudrait arriver à éventuellement
give a good neurosis, and then you can symbolize when the migraine can go.
Alors il se peut très bien que la société pressent tout cela et que pour satisfaire l'exigence
it will be that a society will follow this demand for a certain marginalization of some members. This small portion of society is the necessary luxury requested by the symbolic. This is what Lévi-Strauss said about sorcerers in his introduction to structural anthropology. The sorcerer is this site society in which society focalizes the disease, the anomia, as a fixation. The creation of monastic marginalities followed the same need for the symbolic. There was something that allowed for a cure. This is the cenobitic margin. Within this margin, there can be a second margin, that of idiorhythmy. Historically, diachronically, idiorhythmy, we've seen it several times, is the first known marginality. Anachorites, hermits, marginalize themselves with respect to society, to the state, even before there were monasteries. In Egypt, where you had most eremitic structures, anachorets, at the beginning, were above all individuals who were avoiding taxation or avoiding military service. That was the objective determination of their marginality. Didn't want to pay taxes, didn't do their military service. There is a refusal to be integrated into productive forces of society. Idiorhythmy became a secondary marginality, a marginality contained within a marginality of cenobitism. How did this happen? As soon as you had cenobitism, at the beginning of cenobitism, we have very often the institution of convents in Egypt by Pacomius, Saint Pacomius. Let's always remind ourselves of the temporal, historical, political concomitants between the founding of the first monasteries and Christianity's accession to power in the fourth century. The workers of cenobitism assessed the risks, the dangers of eremitism. These risks, these dangers, were interpreted differently. They were interpreted on different levels. There was first a psychic risk. To live alone is dangerous. It's the risk of a terrible spleen, of nocturnal fantasies, a strong risk of depression. The monk's depression, this is what I analyzed in the figure of acidity. Then there is another risk, the pecaminous risk. It brings about sin. To live alone is badly seen. There is a risk of infatuation. self-love, egoism, pride, laziness. And in the cenobitic horizon, solitude is seen as a weakness. The hermit shuts himself away because he lacks the strength to face daily clashes with other people's wills. He's a coward, in fact. Common living in a convent is a series of difficulties. It's difficult to live together. His difficulties make for self-improvement. These are the risks that follow from the requirement of social integration, a requirement of integration imposed to the individual by society. Every society imposes on the individual as a natural law the idea of living together. One says then in that horizon that hermits are fated to non-communication. As you know, Christianity, at that time especially, is a space of hearing.
But
of sins. So a space where sins are heard. The only mode of confession was a public confession. What was called auricular confession was a public was followed the public confession. The hermit is unable to communicate with his brothers, cannot talk about victories and defeats, no communication. The second social sin is eccentricity. In other words, an individual's subversion of the norms of social life, the level of physical appearance, like clothes, what you wear, your beard, all this is extremely regulated, whereas a single monk can be an eccentric. Also, at the level of mortification, you have an explosion in the 4th century of ascesis. There was an enormous originality in the mortifications to which solitary monks would submit their bodies. They would only live of herbs and roots. You also had the dendrites. They would nest in trees to be closer to the heavens. You had the recluses. They would shut themselves away. You had the stationaries. These were individuals living in a society or a group, but never communicating with it. They don't speak, they don't move like statues. They don't think or drink. They remain out in the open. A variety was the stylites, who would spend years on top of a column. The latent, or at times explicit, condemnation of eremitism in the name of cenobitism is the condemnation of society facing individualism. There is a secular tension between the voice of society as a community, establishing the need for social stimulants. Society spends its time imagining the necessity of stimulants. In my adolescence, you had a certain request for boy scoutism. It's a method of social stimulation. It never had a great effect on me, or unhappy rather. You have the voice of society requesting the individual to integrate himself or herself. And then there is the voice of asocial, solipsistic mysticism. Society imposes a law of integration that's actively undermined by eremitism. You understand the stakes here. What is condemned in marginality is, in fact, what is condemned in the marginal of the idiorhythmy is, in fact, the madman. The norm is what is communal, the community. The madman is abnormal. Perhaps there's no other definition of the madman except for the paranoiac than this. The madman has no power at all, devoid of any power. Whence his excessive position in society, excessive because it's neutral. And society hates that. The madman is neither for nor against power. He can be outside. And it's unbearable, untenable. The madman or the marginal create anxiety. The foundation of the first monastery by Pacomius was a decisive moment. This is the moment when Christian madness has been recuperated by law, by community. The mad people have been subjected to the law of the community, to a chief. There was a submission to what Nietzsche called gregariousness. The margin is nevertheless tolerated, but it has to be controlled by society, coded by society. Society can stand marginals as long as they are controlled or coded. For instance, there was a progressive coding of eremitism in the Occident until the end of the 10th century. There was the proximity between the eremit and the convent. In the 11th and 12th century, eremitism became cenobitism. This is the laureate solitude or the Carthusian type integrated in a convent. In the 13th century, the integration of the order of hermits, for instance, the order of Saint Augustine, a sort of communal eremitism, denying the principle of eremitism. the desert, which was a real and mythical reality, was replaced in the convent by taking a vow of silence in the convent. As a general rule, Occidental eremitism was immediately very integrated. It was sociable and social. One called this the works of eremitic forgiveness and friendship, humanitas hospitalitatis. Then society keeps a close eye on the margin. Hermitages get built within the precincts of abbeys. The hermits are dependent on the abbey, which is a negation of the basic idiorhythmic premise, and the ecclesiastic society controls idiorhythmy. It imposes two values on the monk. That's the fundamental status, obedience and stability, the two values that are essential to the monk's integration and to the hermit's integration. We'd have to append a whole dossier on the social repression of marginalities. The legal repression of certain abnormalities, drugs, mental disorders, and when not explicitly authorized by laws, repression by the police. It's well known that after the American example, there were communes, like hippie communes in France after 1968, in farms and villages that had been abandoned. The small communities had a hard time to find a place to settle. The prefects refused to supply those people with lists of abandoned villages. When, as soon as you had a little community in an abandoned farm, you would have police raids. This is about marginality. It's still an open file. And I come to another figure. But next Wednesday, we'll have a different figure, food. I'd like to talk about a Greek word. Which refers to the status of the solitary person, monosis, like matesis, you have monosis. The etymology is necessary. All regressive, but it's my own taste for etymologies. Monk comes from a Latin form, monicus. But monicus is an altered form of monastic. Monachos in Greek. Monachus, Monachos. Monachus gave the Italian Monaco. and moine in French. In German, Mönch. In Old Provençal, Monge. It's a bit of the feel of the word monk. Monachos means in Greek. Monachus in Latin, Monachos in Greek, mean exactly the solitary person. Precisely, the person who lives without a family. Can't you understand? Well, it's the state of being non-married, it's a bachelor. So the loins have been tied up together, girded loins. It's the symbol of virility, but a controlled virility. It is a type of ascetic, renounces conjugal living. This is the model of one opposed to two. I don't want to get into the vast, immense dossier of the one and the two. It goes into the murmur of modernity from Lacan to Mao. I'll simply remind you of the implicit ideology of the way languages are structured by power. If we interrogate this problem from the point of view of language, in French, we have only one several, singular, plural. But as you know, in many other languages, you have an opposition between one, two, several, the dual. In Greek, for instance, the dual in Greek, each time you have only two objects. This dual, we can say, it comes from a bodily evidence. The human body has many pairs: eyes, ears, arms, legs, hands, testicles. The body offers or imposes the image of a natural unity of the two. Two is one. This is what the body tells us. This two that is one has been dramatized by the myth of Androgyne in Plato's Symposium. This myth describes the painful separation of the bodies and organs. What this means is that the one, the single body, is already virtually divided. The most basic theme is the pair. Whence, the insertion dialectic between one, the virtual division of the one, the body, two, the pair reconstituted as a whole. This is the fusion of love. This is the mating, the bonding process with birds. Coupling is a whole. The dialectic is comprised of the two movements. One is made up of two. The two is a whole. should always situate oneself in that oscillation. A few words about the desire for two. The dossier I'm opening here is not that of loving desire, of the desire for union, for loving fusion. I have done this already. I'm merely noting that in this ambivalence of the dialectic I refer to, the one is construed as a punishment. Condemned to being one is to be punished for something. Robinson Crusoe, one of our characters, repeatedly articulates this belief. Being condemned to live alone on a desert island is being made to pay for the sins of his youth. Above all, his defiance of his father, who had forbidden him to set sail. After the shipwreck, he takes stock of his situation. Being all alone, he gives vent to the desire for two, the desire of the two. Oh, that there had been but one or two, nay, all but one soul saved out of this ship. All the suspense in that story is about the discovery of another one. I will that state this. Two is the suspense of one. It's the anticipation of one. One is pregnant with two. The myth of Adam expresses this. Adam was created alone. He was one, ace, one. But the creation of Eve is nothing less than the actualization, the materialization of the latent duality inscribed within Adam from the beginning. It's the same scheme as for the androgyne. But according to Aristophanes in the Symposium, the division of the one into two is distressing, painful. It's Zeus's punishment for the arrogance of androgynous happiness. The androgyne was so happy that Zeus couldn't take this. Zeus divides the androgynous beings and cuts them in two. Like eggs or cornichons. Happiness is the one as a composite, the one as a pair. All my argument rests on this, the one as a composite. In Genesis, in the Christian Genesis, the fall comes after the division. It's after the division between Adam and Eve that we have sin, the sin comes from the division, but it is in fact blamed on Eve. It's not so much one and two that have to be opposed, it's composite one and divided one. Here we have the praise of the one that is systematically produced in patrology. Monosis is the movement whereby the subject mimics Adam's condition prior to being divided into two. The monosis is to find Adam's solitude, a solitude virtually pregnant with the two. Monacos is not just an unmarried man, a bachelor, but it is also to have a life with a single purpose, one single aim. The Monacos is monotropos, tropain, to turn to it, monotropia. It's an investment in a single object. We would say today that it's sort of mania. We have this in Plato's description of love in the Symposium. It's assimilated to a madness, to a monomania. It's a passion. Passion is not eros, but mania, madness. To be mad because one invests in a single object. Next to this fantasy of unity, the society, the world, is the space of sharing, of mixing, of the divided two. For instance, one who is married is said to be torn, to be divided. The monk, Monacos, is not shared, is pure, is unmixed. The married man is divided, not the monk. The opposition is between the monk who has no division and the husband who is torn. We find this in the Greek haplotes. Haplotes means simplicity, no division, rectitude, the experience of the composite one, integration. The opposite is dipsukhya. Dipsukhya, the state of someone who is double divided. In the Greek of Bible, psuche means the heart, the affective soul. We have the same paradigm in another important opposition of the period. Bios practicos, practical life, and bios theoreticos, contemplative life. Bios practicos, it's like the remarks about praxis and theory in aggregation papers. In the field of patristics, is a political and social activity. It's not pejorative. We valorize the presence in the world. The bios theoreticos is contemplative life, it's unified life. It's good for older men after a period of bios practicos. Is simply the opposition between the mixed and the pure. Bios practicos, it's divided life. A biblical character who is the typical example is Joseph. Joseph in the Ancient Testament, Joseph is irresolute, he is divided. He has a coat of many colors. He is opposed to the one who lives in a desert, a place of calm, of activity without variation or mixture. Bios theoreticos. The dream of bios theoreticos implies to get out of social responsibility. There's nothing anachronic. We can see it today, every day. In many fantasies of today, in each of us, we find this fantasy in many members of communes or communities. There was a certain experience of living together, the communard, as they would be called. One was interviewed in a farm in Ardèche, for instance. He replied to justify what he was doing there. He answered like a monk, the bios theoreticos. I want a quiet life, a life with no noise. I don't want a life that grates all day long. It's Adam's dream. Esukia. For the one of Monachos, of the Anachorite, is a composite one who, like Adam, in his absolute retreat, in his absolute solitude, in fact, is in a loving retreat. It's a dual retreat. Cassien says this, talking about a famous Anachorite, Paphnutius. This is the hero of Thais by Anatole France. Paphnutius wanted to live alone in order to unite more completely with the master to whom he longed to be inseparably attached. It's the two in the one. There are here substitutes for sublimation. As the body and grammar said, the true unity is dual. For me, this figure suggests an investigation, a question, a hypothesis, something I have a vague notion about, which this is it. What's opposed, what therefore produces meaning, isn't so much the one and the two, but rather the integrated one and the disintegrated one. Whence the following remarks. The notion of being torn, this sukhya, is fundamental. It refers to that existential feeling of panic when confronted with a situation, a lifestyle, in which the subject is required to submit to contradictory rules. If I am given at the same time opposite injunctions, I've already talked about this. This is a pre-psychotic situation. It's the problem of the double bind. It can be summed up in the formula given by Freud and Bruno Bettelheim, heads I win, tails you lose. That's a double bind. In the world, this is our general situation. Each of us is asked to be tumultuously, with arrogance, to submit to conflicting responsibilities. We are thus the opposite of aplates. Esukia would be an integrated state of unity, a degree zero of responsibility, of not being torn. This is the stake of monosis. Methodologically speaking, we mustn't think of the one and the two as endowed with attributes. The opposition is between peace and conflict. One and two are more metaphors. One would refer to a subject outside who has wholly integrated the law. Two refers to a subject with both submissive and rebellious in the grips of the long, hard history of repression. That's about Maladie. And if I have 10 minutes left, I'll start the last figure for today, before food. I'll talk about names in the plural. This figure aims at opening the huge file of proper names in the space of living together. I just give 3 points of reference or of departure, just perspectives. First, the problem of nicknames. It's a vast problem for historical ethnology, especially with our surnames, family names. They were either place names, this is the case for my name, places that were flooded by rivers in the south of France. I would read often newspapers article about the misery of Barthes, places that was flooded. There wouldn't be any growth of vegetables for animals there. Our family names are going back to names of places or nicknames from professions, physical characteristics. In the Christian world, the mechanism of onomatogenesis appears in France and in the Western world in this way. Before, there were only Christian names. The mechanism of the creation is the following. Within a very small community, for instance, a family, it's unlikely that first names will be repeated. Each member is distinctive. Within a family, among the collaterals, one doesn't give twice the same name. The family constitutes an onomastic paradigm, no repetition. And if the community grows, becomes a tribe, a village, it's vital to distinguish between bearers of the same first name. That's why you add a nickname. The nickname then becomes a family name. If you have two John, not in the same family, if you have two subjects called John, you would say dark John or fair John. If you have two Henrys, you would say Henry the blacksmith or Henry the peasant. You see how the process separates. There is the production of a second name that differentiates. There was somebody called Guppy Red Hands. And there was the family of Goupil. Each Goupil was distinguished. Goupil Red Hands, Goupil Tonkin. You find the same thing in Proust with the Guermantes. The Duke, the Prince, and so on. In this process, you have the fundamental problem of linguistics, the shifter. The existence of a unit that is only meaningful in the context in which it is used, spoken. The dictionary cannot give you the meaning. It comes only from the situation. In the case of I cannot be defined except by I who says I. Other shifters like here, now. These shifters can only be understood in the situation. When I say Jean, in the space of the family, it's a shifter. It doesn't refer to a lexical essence, to a semantic. There is no Joannity. It refers to a distinctive entity that's dependent upon the context. Within the family, I understand immediately. Outside, I can't. I am lost. I had signaled in another seminar a postcard signed that says, without any date, I'm coming back tomorrow, signed Jean-François. Now, I know of 5 or 6 people called Jean-François. How will I know? Even within a group of friends, you can understand the mechanism. If I know 2 Jean-François, which one, I will ask. You know, the medical student, this is the doctor. His name would be Jean-François, doctor. When we start moving toward the nickname as surname, we de-shift language. We draw closer to the dictionary. The dictionary is the opposite of shifters. The dictionary of proper names exists, is a depragmatization of language. Mm-hmm. there is an existential rapport between family names and the theme of bureaucracy insofar as it is oppressive. Personally, I see as an insult or aggression a letter that says Bart, Roland. It means that my family name comes first, and Roland is a shifter, Bart is not a shifter. Bart is what bureaucracy feeds on in a list, in a computerized list. In our corpus, we have a trace of this problem in the Magic Mountain. As you know, it's a close community in a sanatorium. They are in close contact, but they don't actually know each other very well. They don't know each other's surnames. We see generally a feature, a distinguishing feature for one character. At the beginning you hear Frau Magnus, the one with an albumin deficiency. Before long, it will be hyphenated, and it will be a nickname. She will be called Frau Albumin. This is a device that you find in the epic. It's typical of a narrative. In Homer, Athena, these are the epithets. She's the goddess with blue-green eyes. The names for Indians, Eye of the Lynx. The names for the gods of the Taoist religion, the god of hairs. Thousands of, lots of gods, there's one for hair. There is a god of eyes, inspector of the void. There could be an avenue to explore the relation between the nickname and the narrative. Again, in the Magic Mountain, we have the birth of a real nickname, the Mexican lady, Mrs. Tous les deux. Unhappily, it's because one of her sons is dying and the other, who has come to visit his brother, has fallen ill. She's only capable of saying, tous les deux, tous les deux. The tragic formula had become a nickname. This is all about nicknames. I have to stop here. See you next Wednesday.